So, good evening, everyone. This is a historic occasion. First activity of the Bhatia Foundation. And also, first time I've ever taught a retreat in the English language in Thailand. I think I taught a weekend retreat overseas before. So I'm usually speaking in Thai. So it's a new experience for me here in Thailand. And we're going to start off with precept ceremony. But before we do that, I'll just say a few words about precepts and sila and why we, not just how we do this, but why we do it. Have you talked about this? No. Okay. And so the word vinaya is a word that most people, at least in Thailand, associate with the monastic order, with the Sangha, and we'll immediately think of the 227 rules or main rules of monastics. In fact, the meaning of Vinaya is much wider, much more comprehensive, and the Buddha himself referred to his teachings most commonly by the word Dhamma Vinaya. So we can summarize very simply that the Dhamma teachings refer to the training and education of the inner world and the Vinaya of the of our conduct in the external world. And it's unfortunate that this word Vinaya has been neglected or overlooked so often, because it has led to many distorted representations of Buddhism, most particularly that it's only concerned with the inner reality, and that Buddhist training can lead to passivity, and the idea that the external world and the problems of the external world are not our concern. Our job is to find a way of living within the external world, however it would be, without suffering. In fact, the Buddha taught that we all have responsibility to try to create environments which are as conducive to the practice of Dhamma as possible, conducive to human flourishing as much as is possible. And the one of the main means by which we can accomplish that, at least within our own families and communities, is by a systematic training of our actions and speech. Now, the idea behind it is that we take on certain undertakings, certain kinds of training, in order to create the atmosphere within our families and communities which is most conducive to the attainment of our goals and to the preservation and upholding of our values. So in a daily life situation, the five precepts form that basic foundation. They are not commandments from on high, but they are trainings that we take upon ourselves. So, for instance, the first precept involves us saying, I undertake the training of conduct through by refraining from hurting and harming others. So it's very important to understand precepts as voluntary undertakings. For instance, if you have a system, religion or cult or of any kind, in which people are compelled to refrain from certain kinds of actions or threatened with physical violence or punishment if they should transgress any particular rule, then that would be maybe would lead to certain peace and order in a community, but it wouldn't be the training or the education of conduct which is laid down by the Buddha, because the sense of taking on these undertakings voluntarily is absolutely essential to it. And to take it on voluntarily means to see the suffering involved in not keeping to a precept and the virtue and the benefits of living within the precepts. So that these twin reflections accompany us throughout Buddhist training and becomes habitual to us. That, in everyday language, in English, we say pros and cons, seeing the good and the bad points of things, but in particular, the long-term, short-term suffering involved in the kind of behavior that we want to abandon, and the value and the freedom from suffering which will result from the abandonment of that kind of behavior. So the underlying idea of the precepts and of creating a vinaya, a shared commitment to certain ways of relating to each other, is that we create an atmosphere of trust and safety. And any kind of opening, any kind of willingness to open up within, to uncomfortable, unpleasant things, to let go of things that we are strongly attached to, that can only take place when you feel safe. And so one of the primary goals of a family, of a community, should be that sense of safety and care. and this is what is provided by this commitment to the first five precepts. Now, on in a retreat environment, then our goals are slightly more specific and more elevated, in that we are we've come together to put some time into working on the Dhamma training, the inner training. And so now our criteria is, what standards, what agreements should we come to in our relation with each other in this particular environment to create the conditions most conducive to the practice of Dhamma? And so the third precept, refraining from adultery and cheating on our partners and loved ones, and betraying trust in marital relations, is the precept of celibacy, and taking a time where, as a layperson, you step back and just put down your whole sexual identity for the duration of the retreat. And it means like we die to that identity for a few days, and refraining from certain behaviors which are not evil in themselves. There's no kind of heavy Puritan condemnation of sensuality or sexuality as such for the lay Buddhist, except that there is a reminder that sensual and sexual desires are extremely powerful and can easily become obsessive and come out of balance. So for a certain period of time, stepping back from that kind of conduct and that identity allows a new perspective on it, and to see whether or not it is in balance in our life, and whether we are have a healthy relationship to our sensual and sexual desires. There's nothing that can upset the mind and confuse the mind and undermine meditation as much as very strong sensual and sexual desires. And so stepping back from those desires in the course of a period of intensive retreat is extremely helpful and conducive. the preparation of food, the consumption of food, the digestion of food, this is all work that our bodies have to do every day of our lives. And our relationship to food can often become quite neurotic. And just as with sex or any other sensual pleasure, it can become a crutch and something that we turn to escape from deeper problems. And having only one meal a day or two meals a day, eating only in during the morning period, firstly frees up a lot of time for meditation and other constructive activities, and the reduction of food, giving the body much less need to work on digestion of food, also makes the mind brighter, and lightness of the body can create conditions for lightness of the mind. And monks and monastics who eat one meal a day and generally find that their need for sleep is reduced by reduction of intake of food, particularly by refraining from eating heavy meal in the evening. So clarity of mind, lightness of body, lightness of mind, these are things that we hope to achieve by refraining from eating in the afternoon and evening. Also, it is a practice of austerity and a practice of going against the grain and doing something that probably we would never think of doing otherwise, and realizing that it's not so difficult after all. And when you do have this kind of practice, which, as they say, is not, you know, it's not an enlightening practice in itself, but it is something that requires a certain amount of patience and going against the grain. And it reveals to us that, we can do things like this that perhaps we didn't think that we could do, and opens up avenues to other kinds of austerities, which undertaken wisely, can accelerate the practice of meditation. In conjunction with the celibate precept, then this is also a time in which you can just put down this whole burden of concern about personal appearance, and how much time, especially probably even these days, much more for women than for men. How much time and concern, worry and mental effort is put into appearance and grooming and cleaning and so on and so forth, And how much we come to identify with our physical appearance and the kind of image that we project in the world through the way we dress, through the way we wear our hair, and so on and so forth. Again, during the period of a retreat, firstly, it's an opportunity to put down that burden for a few days, take a holiday from that, and be a completely asexual being for a few days. But it's also, again, an opportunity just to step back from habitual behaviors just for a short period of time and assess to what extent that they are balanced and normal, and to what extent perhaps they become obsessive and become too much of a concern for us. The last precept is probably a little bit the one that seems a bit kind of strange about refraining from high and luxurious beds, and maybe think, well, why is like a high bed any worse than a low bed? It's not really the height or the measurement of the bed, as much as it's an undertaking to relinquish the pleasures of sleep, in that the body, we all need certain amount of sleep, get sick if we don't, it's very bad for our health, but exactly how much sleep that we need is not a sure thing. It varies from person to person, and from one person maybe from different times in their life, and depending on how much activity that they're involved in, stress levels and so on. But we do tend to use sleep as a way of escaping from unpleasant experiences, and to indulge in sleep. Again, you might think that if you have a very busy and heavy life, then a bit of indulgence in sleep and having a lay-in in the morning is on a weekend is you know, hardly a sinful deed. And I would agree, of course. But during a retreat, the idea is to simplify everything as much as possible, and to come down to basics and to what we really need, rather than what we want and what we like or what we're used to. So a little bit of discomfort, a little bit of going against the grain. Not too much, and not making a fetish out of it and thinking that we're special because we can do difficult things, but just as a means of getting a little bit out of your comfort zone. And that's a very useful attitude in spiritual life. So the precepts are there for us to reflect on. And they are also objects of mindfulness. So there is often this idea that keeping precepts, then we're ready to embark on the practice of mindfulness. It's a prerequisite for practice, when in fact it is one part of practice. It is mindfulness is not like a quality that just sort of floats, like an awareness that's there in the air. But you have to be mindful of something. You have to have a clear object of mindfulness to create that kind of clarity of mind that is needed. And the precepts provide the first level of pegs for mindfulness, things that prevent you from losing track of where you are and what you're doing and why you're doing what you're doing. So the eight precepts don't cover everything, and we can still undermine our practice in unnecessary ways, which is why usually in the retreats, make a point of keeping silent or keeping to right speech, meaning only speaking when absolutely necessary. Again, this is a very good meditation practice. It's not something, you know, outside of the practice. It's very much a practice in itself. We have so many habits, bad habits, that we've developed in our speech. And to be able to recognize them more easily is not easy. But taking on a practice of refraining from speech for a certain period of time allows us to see that intention to speak and to see, for instance, how often we speak just to because we find silence uncomfortable, or we're afraid that the people we are with will find our silence uncomfortable. And maybe you've been at home and you're just quietly sitting there and minding your own business, and then somebody says, "Are you angry with me? Is there something wrong?" And all you've done is not speak for a few minutes. In many situations, people read things into silence and make silence seem uncomfortable for everyone. And in fact, you probably know that one of the measures of a healthy relationship is when two people, or more than two people, can be together in silence and quite comfortably. That's a sign of a very mature relationship. Not speaking because they're upset with each other and just turning their back on each other, but not feeling the need to fill in the spaces all the time. So in a meditation retreat, it's like a luxury in that can spend the whole day without saying a word, and no one will take it in the wrong way and think that you're upset or angry with them, and that we can all share this practice of silence together. So, you know, there may be exceptions when something needs to be said, but really making this part of your mindfulness practice is notice when you have this intention to speak, and so what, you know, swallow it down, and then just look, what was that? Why did I want to say something? For what purpose? So in terms of gaining a more clearer and honest awareness of what's going on in your mind, the intention to speak is one of the most revealing habits that we have. And as I say, because the intention to speak is usually expressed almost immediately, restraint of speech is very difficult. And to get some kind of a handle on it, and to get some initial experience of how to be more mindful of speech, refraining from speech altogether for a certain period of time is a very good way to begin. So these are a few initial comments and thoughts and reflections on precepts, and now we can continue with the ceremony itself.